2003 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents Session 373, Palestinian Legitimacy, a panel featuring Jay Bonarici, Father James Flynn, Francis Ramelide, Gary Whittison, and Carolyn Barani.
Good afternoon. We're going to start talking. We're going to show a video. So please forgive or cut us a little slack as we work to get it set up and prepare to show it. I'm Bonarici. I'm part of the board of Sunstone and a longtime observer of conditions in Palestine and other quarters of the world. And we're delighted to have you here in this session today. We have some interesting presenters and a video that we want to show you. Let me just suggest, as we're getting right here, two or three perspectives. First of all, there's the same number of Mormons, Jews, and Muslims in the United States. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's a kind of interesting dynamic. In John Krakauer's book, he talks about the fact that there are more Mormons than Jews in the world. And, you know, it's hard to measure because nobody knows for sure who's what when you start doing computations, census calculations, and so forth. But, yeah, you want to pull that door shut? But at any rate, there are about the same number in the country. But very differential power. In terms of Congress. You look at the makeup of Congress, and there's not an equal number of Mormons, Jews, and Muslims in the U.S. Senate, House. I don't have the numbers for the current Congress, but at one time we had about the same number of Mormons as in the Congress as in the population, about the same percentage. It was about 17. There were no Muslims and 72 Jewish members of Congress. A kind of interesting issue in terms of a population representation. That creates some interesting realities of the way we do foreign policy, of the way the Congress works. I don't suggest it as insidious in any way. It's just a kind of interesting reality. I know Jewish producers in Hollywood who say, of course, we dominate Hollywood. What do you expect? If you want to get your message out, where would you go? What would you try and control? And only 72% of the Hollywood power structure are Jewish. But still, it's a notion that's kind of interesting in terms of that. Again, I'm not. I don't say that to be demeaning. There's a kind of romance also that I think we need to put in perspective. The stories are fascinating about the traditions, and the stories are told. The number of writers, the number of musicians that tell the stories, the Holocaust writers, Elie Wiesel, for example, who's written so eloquently about the Holocaust. I think it's telling that in his later life, he won the Nobel Prize for his writing as a Holocaust survivor. He was asked what his greatest regret was in life. And this is a passionate Jewish survivor of the Holocaust. He says, "My greatest regret is that I did not do more for the Palestinians." I found that kind of interesting as in his late 80s, surviving the Holocaust, and the books he'd written, the things he'd done, his classic book, Night, for which he won the Nobel Prize, but I did not do enough for the Palestinians. But we do romanticize. We have the stories, we have the movies, we have Exodus, we have so many things written. And in Mormon culture, we have the added kind of interesting issue of terminology. The term Israel is used so extensively in Mormon culture, and the term Zion, the number of hymns in the hymn book, in the hymnal, that have the term Zion are kind of interesting. And so we have an identification. We think we're of a children of Abraham, and that we share a kind of claim of the tribes of Israel. And a lot of things that make us romanticize the position and the reality of contemporary Israel. Times I've spent, I've lived there many, many years in Jerusalem and Jordan and other places. One of my favorite signs in Gaza is a sign that says green grass is a terrorist act. I don't know, Gary, if you've seen that billboard in... did you get to Gaza much? Sign that says green grass is a terrorist act. And the issue is that in the Gaza Strip, the most densely populated area on Earth, 5 miles wide, 20 miles long, there are 1.3 million Palestinians and 4,000 Israeli settlers. The 4,000 Israeli settlers live in guarded, enclosed settlements, and they have 40% of the land and 70% of the water. 4,000 versus 1.3 million. And the reason it's so densely populated is because that 40% of the land is off limits to Palestinians, and the roads that connect those settlements are off limits. And so they're limited to the refugee camps and to the very limited settlements on Yunus and Gaza City and the camps. And it's a brutal and a tragic world. 40% of the land, 70% of the water, 1.3 million people versus 4,000. And therefore, the water that goes to make those home lawns green is a terrorist act. Now, you don't have to agree with that, but understand the power of that particular position. Well, let me just mention one more variable in terms of my involvement. I've been involved in that part of the world for a long time. My involvement became serious in 1989. When I was invited to go to Jerusalem by BYU. I was a professor at BYU at the time, and I was debating whether to go. And the academic vice president requested that I come to a meeting. He said the meeting's in Salt Lake. I got to his office at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. We drove up to Salt Lake, and the meeting consisted of Howard W. Hunter, James Faust, and Jeff Holland. Those of you who aren't Mormons might realize those are important people in the hierarchy of the LDS Church. And President Faust said to me after 30 seconds of small talk, I understand you're going to Jerusalem. And I said, well, I haven't decided yet. He said, well, it's not a good time. I was a department chair. I had business commitments. I had children's commitments. And he said, well, can you decide to go? Can you decide right now? And I said, I guess, why? He said, we want you to go build bridges to the Palestinians. And I said, gee, why me? He said, I don't know anything about the area. I've only been there once as a tourist, and I don't speak Arabic. And I said, what do I have to offer? He said, well, I'm not sure. He says, but you're in organization behavior. You do management training. You can go teach people how to run a business. He said, you can do something that's non-controversial. And it kind of was offended me that I would be accused of doing something non-controversial. But at least management training seemed to be preferable to political agitation or something. And so my family and I moved to Jerusalem in 1989. Since then, I've spent about a total of 5 years living in either Jerusalem or Amman, Jordan, visiting professor at Birzeit University in the West Bank, University of Jordan, American University of Beirut, and have recently been in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Riyadh and Bahrain and Cairo. I was in Cairo during the time that we were conducting our military excursion in Iraq. And so I've had a fair amount of experience. I'm still not an expert. I still don't know much about it, but I have lots of observations and lots of feelings. And so we want to share our perceptions with you, our unique perspectives. Not that they're absolute truth. They're subject to debate, and they are all idiosyncratic. They're all our experience, but we'd like you to experience some of the things we have experienced in that critical and fascinating part of the world. Is the video ready? So let me introduce our panel also, and then I'll go. The video is called What Americans Need to Know About Israel's Occupation of Palestine. It was a speech given at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor by Jane Zaru, a Christian Palestinian, just a couple months ago. And this is a speech that we'd like you to hear. Following that, we'll ask Francis Rimelard, who's one of the three founding directors of Utahns for Just Peace in the Holy Land, a United Methodist Church activist, a very articulate chemist, who came to Utah with an assignment with Francis, the U.S. Geologic Survey, as a chemist, and then stayed around for several years, and is now working with this group, along with James Flynn, who is a Catholic priest, St. Mary's in Park City, sort of retired, but working there, and has done extensive work, liberation theology in Nicaragua and Guatemala, and will share some perspectives on the Catholic Church's position on the Holy Land. And we have Gary Whittison. Gary is a Foreign Service officer, is currently posted in Tokyo, was officially posted in Muscat, Oman, which is an interesting old ancient Arab city, and in the American consulate in Jerusalem, and so has that perspective. And where's Carol? Oh, here she is. And Carolyn Brani, who is a local activist, a Latter-day Saint, married to a Muslim, and has been an activist for human rights in Palestine, and is a passionate crusader who organizes and rallies people to the cause. After the video, first we'll hear from Francis, who will give a short framing of that, and then we'll ask Gary to give his perspective. Then we'll ask Carolyn, and then Father Flynn, who will sort of give us a little different perspective and a kind of framing. So, can we go ahead?
Thank you. When you speak of curfew, it's not that negative in this society. It's something positive that your daughter should come back at a certain hour. For us, it's a different thing. We are locked down in our houses day and night, not allowed to go to work or to school or to farm the fields or do anything. And if people get out, they get shot. I know a woman whose father and brother in Nablus were shot from the tent fire in the houses while they were in the house. She couldn't get out. She stayed with her kid's father and brother for a week because she was frightened to get out. This is what curfew is all about. I have lived all my life in Ramallah and more than half of my life under Israeli military occupation. But it was never as difficult as it is today. While Israeli troops are amassing in the occupied territories, and with the siege tightening, we are increasingly subjected to a policy of persistent shelling, political assassinations, abductions, house demolitions, and the destruction of crops and trees. Restriction on movement, checkpoints, closures, confiscation of land and water resources are making life unlivable for all. Just want to give you some statistics since September 2000. Do you know that 2,350 Palestinians were killed, of whom are 1,911 civilians? We say it's not right to kill civilians. We had 1,911 civilians that were killed. 469 of them were children. Only 314 Palestinians were killed in combat. And the number of suicide bombers that died in this action is 125. The Israelis since September 2000, the Israeli government or the military forces uprooted 227,997 olive and fruit trees. Now when you speak about olive and fruit trees, these take such a long time to give fruit. They are not evergreen just to make the community beautiful. They are the main livelihood of many people. And they are uprooting more to build the wall, and they enforce curfew so people would not resist. And there is an Israeli company that comes and takes these olive trees when they are uprooted under curfew, and they sell them in Israel for a high price.
Unfortunately, this comes on the area where the Israeli government thousands of centimeters of land and is destroying thousands of olive trees to build a wall of separation, to lock Palestinians in their villages, deprive them of their farmland and their livelihoods.
Houses or homes were completely demolished. We're not talking about the partial, you know. This is since September 2000. Leaving about more than 500,000 Palestinians homeless. To be exact, 543,437 homeless. This is of a population of about 3 million. The percentage is very, very high. The people that were injured since September 2000 are 24,000 Palestinians. Our misfortunes are not few. Our country is becoming one gigantic prison and one vast cemetery. This is what the occupation is doing. When I write my emails from home, I write, I'm writing to you from my prison in Absurdistan. I call my home Absurdistan because what the Israelis are doing is so absurd that you really cannot believe what's happening. To be unable to move in your cars 2 miles north or south or east or west without checkpoint, without having to get out of the car if you are allowed to cross to the other side, is really becoming very, very difficult.
Become hard to find. People are tired and depressed.
They are traumatized by the violence that is perpetuated against them, which affects both their physical and mental health. Do you know that now more than 70% of the Palestinians living under occupation in Gaza and the West Bank are living on less than $2 a day? And this is not because we are originally poor. This is because we are under siege. We cannot go to work. We cannot go, you know, for development, sell our products to the neighboring village or town. We cannot import.
Israel basically doesn't want competition from the Palestinian economy. Every Palestinian wants to export abroad to receive the permission of Israel. So a truck can go to the border of Gaza Strip with full of goods and wait there for days for the permission to be renewed. So often things like vegetable or flowers that Palestinian wants to export from the Gaza Strip just get rotten and they have to throw them away and lose millions of dollars each day.
The malnourishment among children is so high. John Hopkins, the School of Medicine, had a report that two-thirds of the women of childbearing age are anemic. And many of the children, 30% of them, are anemic and malnourished. The most basic form of deception is in fabricating a fake symmetry between occupier and occupied. Every time somebody speaks about the results of that occupation, you know, people are talking about balance and between the occupier and occupied, between oppressor and victim. The violence of the Israeli, powerful Israeli occupation army, which uses live ammunition, tanks, and helicopter gunships, is at best equated with the violence of Palestinian civilians protesting their victimization and continued loss of rights, land, and life. Moreover, if we are not grateful for this form of occupation, colonization, and the isolated Bantustans under Israel's apartheid system, then we will be pounded into submission. Occupation is not simply a reaction to terrorism. This is the way the media have presented it here. The occupation has been going on since 1967. It is not a reaction to terrorism, or quote-unquote, or a means of self-defense. It is an expression of a policy of de facto annexation that began immediately after 1967 and generated over the years a high degree of suffering, violence, and human rights violation. Israel tried to present its military actions and policies of repression as mere reactions to Palestinian violence. In this way, it has made the occupation disappear from the discourse. The failure to uphold people's basic rights feeds hatred and perpetuates abuses. All those in positions of authority must recognize the right of life, physical and mental integrity, freedom from arbitrary detention. We have now the human rights of one individual cannot be founded on the loss of another individual. And in the case of Israelis, they cannot obtain peace or security by oppressing and violating the rights of the Palestinians, who are committed to their basic right to struggle for self-determination and independence. Israel's extensive use of our water resources in the West Bank and Gaza is just another form of violation. We are only allowed to use 15% at most of the water resources of the West Bank and Gaza. While many of our villages go thirsty because they don't have running water and because of the closure they can't have the trucks deliver water to them, many of them have gone really thirsty, their animals have died, their plants died. And while settlements have green lawn grass, they have swimming pools, they have evergreen trees, and this is using our water resources. What about the 200 Israeli settlements or Jewish colonies in the occupied territories? You hear that Sharon is going to dismantle the illegal outposts. He's talking about few settlements with some trailers or, you know, a prefab put in there. He's not talking about these big cities that have usurped most of the land and water resources. And also, they took land to build bypass roads for these settlements to bypass. Why do they call them bypass roads? To bypass the Palestinian reality, to fragment it, and to imprison us in enclaves so the settlers can be safe and use the roads. We're not allowed to use the roads. Imagine if somebody tells you in Ann Arbor that around this library only, you know, such a group can pass by on this road. Or you are not allowed to drive in your car beyond 2 miles in the city. How this is going to affect your work or seeing your family members or going to hospital or going to cultural activities. It's not really a joke. It's translating a whole nation on many, many levels. Economic, political, social, at many, many levels. Now the environmental degradation that is caused by these settlements, where they dump their waste in our fields, the little fields that is left to us, most of the waste is dumped there. In Gaza 2 years ago in March, Gaza was flooded with the septic tanks of one of the settlements next to Gaza, and the dirty water was as high as 1 meter in the streets of Gaza. This would not happen elsewhere without a cry out from the world community. In the US media, you always hear about stopping the violence, and most often the violence of the Palestinians, which is considered again, quote unquote, terror. By doing so, they are ignoring the fundamental imbalance of the situation. Israel is an internationally recognized state with one of the most powerful military forces in the world, including 200 to 300 nuclear warheads and an economy 20 times larger than that of the Palestinians. And it is the occupiers. We, the Palestinians, are fragmented, stateless, impoverished, vulnerable, and traumatized people, 70% of which are refugees and displaced persons, with no sovereignty and only lightly armed militias. And we are occupied, detained, injured, or exiled. Israel is using violence and state terror as repression, systematic violations of human rights in making its occupation permanent. The refusal of the international community to intervene makes it complicit in the violations of human rights and war crimes that Israel is committing in the occupied territory. For me, it is clear the Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem must end. Despite the current Israeli government's intention, no degree of violence can succeed in subjugating the will of a people or destroying their spirit when they are struggling for freedom, dignity, and right to sovereignty on their own land. All Israeli attempts at intensifying the brutality of the occupation against Palestinians have only led to the escalation of the conflict and increased our determination to gain our liberty. Conflicts can only be resolved politically and legally on the basis of parity of rights and the global rule of law. All without double standards should adhere to United Nations resolutions and international law. Israel is not above the law. Thank you very much.
Let's just leave it. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just leave it. It's just okay.
I'm Frances Ree Millard, and I'm very happy to be here today. My comments are short. I think the video says a lot. The subject of our discussion today was to be Palestinian legitimacy. And as I thought about this title, I found that what really troubles me is not the question of Palestinian legitimacy, but the question of our legitimacy and our authenticity. And when I say our, I'm talking about us collectively as Americans. As Americans, we claim democracy as a value, equality of rights, and equality of privileges. Yet we send one-third of our foreign aid to Israel, more money than we send to all of Africa. Israel is a country with one of the highest living standards in the world. It is also not a democracy. I bring up the issue of democracy because I've written many times and met with our legislators many times, and I've gotten many, many letters that the reason we send so much money to Israel is because they are the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel is actually a country where 20% of its citizens are barred from purchasing land, and they're deprived of other privileges too. That's Israel proper. That's not the Palestinian territories, which this video describes. As Americans, we claim to value freedom of the press. And I wonder, what's the value of freedom of the press if it does not keep us informed, does not print the whole truth? I know of no mainstream American media which has ever disclosed to the American people the truth of what's going on in the Palestinian territories. And I'd like to just give you one quick example. We had a California journalist, Allison Weir, spoke in Salt Lake City about a month ago about a study she had done on the San Francisco Chronicle. And I'd like to show you one little piece of her results. She documented the reporting of children's deaths in Israel-Palestine for a 6-month period. And you can see they're about equal, Israelis and Palestinians. And this ought to look pretty familiar to us because that's the way this issue is always presented, sort of a tit for tat among almost equals. In fact, the actual figures are here. And you can see the difference between the deaths of Israeli children and Palestinian children. You can also see why we are so misled on this issue. The second chart shows something closer to what's actually going on there. My own belief is that probably 95 or 99% of the violence is against Palestinians. Palestinians are deprived of their land, their homes, their food, their water, their livelihood, their education, and even the simple freedom to take a walk on a beautiful day. Yet where is that reported in our media? And where does our media report the massive amounts of money in foreign and military aid we send to Israel? $5 billion annually. That's about $14 million each and every day. If anybody's interested, Allison Weir is also doing a study now on the New York Times, and our group is cooperating with her on a study of the Salt Lake Tribune. So it'll be interesting to see what those results are. As spiritual people, most of us members of organized religions, we claim the values which come from God, taught us to us through our books, the Bible, the Torah, and the Quran. Over and over, these books teach the values of love, mercy, being in relationship with our neighbors, the need for justice. Again and again, the need for justice. And yet in the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, many of us are willing to turn our heads, close our eyes, not see, not confront, not be involved, because this situation in Israel might be part of a fulfillment of prophecy, the second coming, as if somehow God would make an exception for our call to do justice, to love, and to be merciful, that he might make an exception in cases of prophecy fulfillment. I wonder how authentic and how solid are we in our spiritual connection that we would assume God would so easily make an exception. Again, I don't think it's the Palestinian legitimacy that's really at question. I think it's our authenticity, our legitimacy, our integrity. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Gary Whittison, and I was born and raised right here in Salt Lake City. For the last 16 years, I've been privileged to work overseas for the U.S. State Department. I work as an administrative specialist, and it will probably be apparent that the opinions I express today are not consistent with the policies of my employer, so please don't quote me as claiming to be a department spokesman. Having grown up in the relative isolation of the Salt Lake Valley, it has been eye-opening to watch up close the conduct of American foreign policy in places such as Ireland, the Philippines, Oman, and Tokyo, Japan, where I currently live. But the most interesting and educational assignment was at the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem, where I served from September of 1999 to July of 2001. This was an especially interesting time to live in Jerusalem, spanning as it did the years before and after the beginning of the current Intifada, or uprising. During my first year there, serious and optimistic Palestinian-Israeli negotiations were being conducted based on the Y River Accords. It is particularly telling that during 1999, only 4 Israelis died from terrorist acts. That's a remarkable number compared to the hundreds of Israelis that have died annually since Ariel Sharon came to power with the slogan, "Peace Through Strength." The relative peace of 1999 reflected both the hope of the Palestinian people that they would soon realize their dream of independence, and the effectiveness of the Arafat-led Palestinian Authority in cracking down on Palestinian violence. The negotiations eventually broke down, of course, with inevitable finger-pointing by both sides. While I was there following the negotiations at Camp David, I noted that at the same time that Israel was promising to remove most Israeli settlements from the occupied lands in exchange for peace, the Israeli parliament was approving the creation of new settlements and allocating additional funding for those settlements. To me, this was a revelation. There are a number of additional issues on both sides, but the linchpin of any agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians would be cessation of violence by the Palestinians and removal of settlements by Israel. During the Y River negotiations, the Palestinian leadership was doing all it could to keep violence down, and terrorist acts had virtually ceased. On the other hand, Israel's government, its parliament, was flaunting the negotiations by expanding settlements. It was as if it were taunting the Palestinians, as well as Prime Minister Barak, for thinking that Israel was serious about peace. How, I thought, could the Palestinians trust Israeli intentions under these conditions? Settlements and the underlying Israeli longing to possess all the land which belongs to the Palestinians are the core obstacle to peace. I'm frustrated and even angry when I hear American politicians express solidarity with Israel with little or no criticism of the ever-expanding settlement process. According to the Israeli group Peace Now, the pattern continues today. On July 23rd of this year, the organization noted that while Israel had dismantled 8 settlements during recent efforts to kickstart the American proposed peace talks, 10 new settlements had been created during the same period. Prime Minister Sharon is on record as saying that the settlements are as much a part of Israel as Tel Aviv, and the decision of whether to remove them is an entirely internal one. Israel wants peace. Make no mistake about that. Yet it is adamant that it won't negotiate the all-important status of settlements until the final phase of peace talks, which means it won't discuss settlements until the Palestinians have disarmed themselves and forsworn violence altogether. Now, sounds reasonable, doesn't it? No one wants to negotiate, as they say, with a gun at their head. The Palestinians, however, are always negotiating with a gun at their head. Let's consider the nature of negotiations between Israel and a fully disarmed Palestinian Authority. The Palestinians would have nothing to offer, so it could hardly even be called a negotiation. They would be entirely dependent on the goodwill of the Israeli nation to reverse decades of its own policy of settling Greater Israel and trusting in their willingness to take on the potentially violent Israeli settlers and their fanatical rabbis in order to dismantle their settlements. It would also mean that they would willingly take on the resettlement of hundreds of thousands of Israelis who live in those settlements. Palestinians rightly laugh at the notion of Israel making such concessions under these circumstances. Any rational person would. The threat of violence is the only card that the Palestinian people have to play at the negotiating table. Yet Israel, backed by most American politicians, want them to discard it prior to any serious negotiations. The Temple Mount in the old city of Jerusalem is a site sacred to Muslims and Jews. On this site stood the Jewish temples of antiquity. It is also the site of the current Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, which is the place from which many Muslims believe Muhammad ascended into heaven. As a Muslim holy site, the top of the mount has long been controlled by Muslim Palestinians. For a long time, an accommodation has existed in which Jews worship at the base of the Western Wall, a massive retaining wall that is all the remains of the last temple, and the Muslims worship at the mosque atop the mount. The temple, of course, was destroyed by Romans 2,000 years ago. It's been an unwritten rule that each side would respect the other's space. I was in Jerusalem the day in September of 2000 when Ariel Sharon, then a powerful politician aspiring to become prime minister, walked up to the Muslim-controlled Temple Mount surrounded by a cordon of soldiers and press members. The news that evening showed an angry Palestinian mob yelling and then throwing rocks. Then Israeli soldiers fired into the crowd. A few Israelis were hurt that day, but four unarmed Palestinians were killed. That day the peace ended and the current intifada began. The day after Sharon's ascent, I had two of my employees come into my office at different times to vent about this tragic affair. One was Israeli, the other Palestinian. The two described the same event, but in diametrically different terms. To one, it was a bold, brave act by an Israeli soldier, an Israeli leader with the guts to show that Israelis can and will go anywhere, any place they want within their own country, only to be met by vicious protesters who hurled rocks, which can, of course, be as deadly as bullets. They threw them even at worshippers and tourists at the Western Wall down below, goading the soldiers into retaliation. The other employee described a deliberately provocative political act by an Israeli leader who already had the blood of thousands of Palestinians on his hands and who was intent on disrupting the peace by forcing action on the part of young Palestinians. The act had its predicted effect. Protest was met by disproportionate force as unarmed men were gunned down in cold blood. This difference in how events are perceived is a significant aspect of the Israeli-Palestinian problem. You must understand, there are right-wing Israelis who are absolutely dedicated to undermining any peace process that involves the return of any of the West Bank or Gaza. Many of these have participated in acts of assassination and terrorism against Palestinians, acts that have gone largely unnoticed and unreported in the United States. They incite violence against Palestinians and honor those who murder Palestinian civilians. Similarly, however, there are Palestinians dedicated to conducting war to the death, who regard any Israeli as a combatant in that war and thus a fair target, and who claim martyrdom for those who die in the struggle. It is worth noting that the extremists on both sides can easily justify murder and oppression by reference to their holiest scriptures. Both of these groups represent smaller minorities, but they receive surprising support from the larger Israeli and Palestinian populations. It is the extremists among the Palestinians who are killing Israelis. It is the extremists among Israelis who are dedicated to expanding settlements and reclaiming the land promised to Abraham by God in the Bible. Neither has any inclination to compromise, and neither will ever willingly acknowledge the point of view of its enemy. Americans who won their own independence by violence and who conquered the land on which we live by violence have surprisingly little empathy for a Palestinian population that has none of the rights that our forefathers fought and died for. They cannot govern themselves, created their own government, control their own economy, raise an army, etc. Notwithstanding Israel's rhetoric, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians accept the permanent existence of Israel and its right to exist. They seek only to achieve nationhood for themselves in accordance with the terms established by the United Nations decades ago, the same United Nations, one might add, that was responsible for the creation of Israel in the first place. Salim is a Palestinian Christian who worked for me in Jerusalem. One weekend, he took me on a drive to a neighborhood just a short jump from the old city and showed me a beautiful and valuable old stonework home behind a high wall. It was his parents' home, he explained, until the day that Israel declared independence in 1948 and the predicted fighting broke out between the new state and armies of the neighboring Arab countries. Salim's parents took their children and fled to the YMCA in the Old City, where they joined other Christian families seeking refuge from the fighting. After months had passed, when the fighting finally ended, they tried to return to their home, but found a Jewish immigrant family living there. Salim's father was never allowed to set foot again in his home, and ended up raising his family in a small apartment in the Old City. He was just one of over 700,000 Palestinians who lost their homes and, in many cases, their right to return to their homeland after the 1948 war. Though he does not condone violence per se, one need only hear the emotion in Salim's voice to understand the frustration that drives the cycle of violence. He and his children are constant victims of Israeli discrimination. His son will soon graduate from a Palestinian college with no prospects for a job. His teenage daughter is harassed by Israeli soldiers when she walks through the checkpoints to go to school each day. Salim points out that without the violence of groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the world would utterly ignore the injustices he and so many others have suffered, and Israel would continue its campaign to expropriate all of the West Bank and Gaza undeterred. Now, there are Americans who believe that God's hand is visible in restoration of the historical biblical lands of the children to the children of Israel, and believe that when we support Israel unreservedly, we are on the side of the Almighty. The return of the Jews to the lands of their inheritance is foretold in the Bible, I hear them say, and those who oppose them are opposed to God also. One hears this from evangelists and, to an alarming extent, from Mormons as well. God may work in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform, but he has provided guidelines for how we humans are to behave. Consider this. There are numerous passages in the Old Testament foretelling the betrayal of Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. The betrayal by Judas Iscariot, along with the subsequent crucifixion of Christ, brought about the atonement for our sins. Yet would any Christian boast of his support for Judas or the others who participated in bringing to pass the words of the ancient prophets? To Mormons, I also point out that Joseph Smith, our first Latter-day prophet, was inspired to prophesy his own martyrdom when he was arrested and taken to Carthage jail. Here we have, in effect, God prophesying a future event, yet do we praise the men of the mob who helped fulfill God's words by assassinating Brother Joseph? I ask you, would you support those who provided arms to the men who helped bring that prophecy to fruition? My point is that whether or not Israel's policies today appear to some to fulfill biblical prophecy, we Mormons, or ethical people of any stripe, should be more concerned with doing what is legal and what is right. God may have destroyed the wicked in Sodom and Gomorrah with great violence, but he has not authorized us to blow up abortion clinics or federal buildings in his name. I'm aware of no instance of God deputizing Ariel Sharon to create and support Israeli settlements in the land promised to Abraham or to Moses. The Old Testament records occasions when the children of Israel were instructed to enslave and even exterminate entire communities, down to the last crying infant. What Christian today believes that God continues to tolerate this kind of behavior? The plight of the millions of Palestinian refugees crowded into sweltering camps should cause us outrage. Yet, for whatever reason, America has in recent years done much to harm the prospects for justice for Palestinian refugees and peace between Israel and Palestinian people. Our leaders and our talk show hosts defend Israel's, quote, right to defend itself, end quote, while ignoring the legitimate demands of the Palestinian people for the fundamental freedoms that come with self-determination. We cannot solve all of the world's problems, but we must at least refrain from supporting those who do oppress others. I left behind friends at the Jerusalem consulate. They were Jewish, Muslim, and Christian. Some were devout believers in their respective faiths, others less so. Yet all were concerned primarily with just providing a decent life for their families. They were all fundamentally good people. And though as an American and as a Mormon, I am by nature an optimistic person, it bothers me, I have to admit, that I have little optimism for the future of those friends that I left behind. America is the only country in the world in a position to broker a just peace in the Middle East, the only nation with a position in a position to pressure both sides to compromise and to discipline their more radical elements. Condemnation of Palestinian violence is commonplace among our politicians. However, even the mildest suggestion by the White House that Israel should curb the violence that results in Palestinian civilian deaths brings forth a cascade of abuse from other politicians defending Israel's actions. A change in heart by the American politicians is necessary if progress is to be made. Politicians change, however, only when their constituents or major contributors demand it. Unfortunately, most Americans are woefully uninformed about the realities in Palestine and seem content when their representatives support Israeli aggression. Many tend to have an uninformed and prejudiced view, equating Palestinians in general with terrorism. Others believe the rabbis or ministers who tell them that God is with Israel and that they are currently witnessing a God-ordained prelude to either the first or second coming of the Messiah. Take your pick. We managed to ignore or justify Israel's own history of terrorism when it was fighting for its own independence, including numerous horrific attacks on civilians. We condemn Yasser Arafat as an obstacle to peace because of his history of violence. At the same time, we ignore the fact that Ariel Sharon and the Israeli military aided and abetted in the massacre of 3,000 unarmed Palestinians by Christian militia under their control in the Sabra and Shatila camps in Lebanon in 1982. Americans appropriately express deep sympathy for those Israelis who die at the hands of suicide bombers. Yet we coldly dismiss the killing of Palestinian civilians by Israeli soldiers, suggesting that the Palestinian women and children and the aid workers who die in the West Bank are somehow deserving of their fate. Yes, atrocities have been committed by both sides in this conflict. Elements on both sides deserve censure. Yet, one receives between $4 and $5 billion annually in aid from the United States, boasts a strong economy with European standards of living, and is protected by a first-rate army armed with American technology. The other side has no nation, no national government, estimated 40% plus unemployment, and large segments of its population who are effectively homeless and living in abject poverty with no real hope for the future. It is no wonder that these people are thrilled to receive aid from groups like Hamas, the only organization that they see caring about their plight. As Americans, we all share responsibility for ensuring that our government's policies serve the purposes of justice throughout the world. The Iraqi people, for instance, could not be blamed for the excesses of Saddam Hussein. But we Americans elected and are responsible for the actions of George Bush and our other representatives. These politicians will bring real pressure to bear on Israel to deal humanely with the Palestinians and to negotiate in good faith for a Palestinian state only when we as their constituents demand it. As a Mormon, I believe that we are all God's children, that God loves all of us, and that he holds us responsible for our actions pertaining to his other children, whether they are Christian, Muslim, or Jew. Collectively, with the light of the gospel, we Mormons should be leaders in seeking justice for all and mercy for the downtrodden. I urge that we all do so. Thank you.
I'll try to hurry along so that we get finished before too long. I was going to give you a little history lesson. I want to ask a question. Well, actually, it's simple enough. Do the Chinese have a right to historic China? Do the French have a right to historic France? And the Russians a right to historic Russia? Do the Palestinians have a right to historic Palestine? Of course, the answer is a resounding yes. All peoples have rights to their personal property, their self-determination, and their homes, including Palestinians, to be able to live in peace and prosperity without fear of aggression from others who covet their land. Although God has promised the Holy Land to all of Abraham's descendants, still, when Sarah died and Abraham bought a cave in which to bury her, Abraham himself did not assume that he had the right to just take the land, in spite of God's promise. In honor, he insisted on paying a great deal for it. God expects Abraham's descendants to behave in a like manner. The Palestinians, like Americans and Jews of the world, are a unique mix of many nations. Hebrew, Greek, Roman, Canaanite, French, German, Turkish, Philistine, Armenian, Arab, you name it. That's only a few of them. Palestine existed before recorded history, and the National Geographic has published an account of the Philistine culture, which, although berated by the Old Testament, was actually a highly developed society of science and art that far outranked the Hebrew shepherds of the time. At the time of Christ, only half of the population consisted of Hebrews, since the Holy Land represents a mosaic of mankind. The term Palestinian was first used by the Romans, who called the land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River Palestinia. When Christ was on the earth, there were Jews who followed him. Although they were of the tribe of Judah, these Jews were no longer called Jews because they had abandoned Judaism. But they became Christians and were part of the growing Christian community. In 69 AD, when the Jewish zealots rebelled, Rome drove the Jews from Jerusalem. Although the Romans didn't always discriminate between the Christian and the zealot Jews, some Christians were caught in the crossfire. But the Christians, by and large, escaped the scourge by fleeing before the siege began, then returned in the spring of 70 AD. Following yet another zealot Jewish rebellion, which included Jewish attempts of coercion of Christians to deny Christ, the Romans, in 131 AD, renamed Jerusalem Aelia Capitolina and forbid that any circumcised person enter or stay in the city upon pain of death. This began the exile of the Jews. However, the Christian Jewish presence in Jerusalem continued uninterrupted from the day of Pentecost until today. The blood of the house of Israel was further dispersed through the region when Islam invaded the area and many Christians converted to Islam. It took Muslim leaders on two occasions to restore the Jews to Jerusalem. In 636 AD by the Caliph Omar, following the expulsion by Rome, and in 1187, Saladin restored the Jews to Jerusalem after the Crusaders had expelled them. Of the three major religions, Islam has proven to be the most tolerant. And on numerous occasions throughout history, Jews driven from European countries have fled to the Muslims for refuge. Jews enjoyed their golden age under Islamic rule in Spain. The Christian community is, by the most part, the remnant of the original followers of Christ and the most persecuted of all of the Palestinian peoples. The Christians have a history of conflict with Jews, which far surpasses any conflict between Muslims and Jews. In the year 614 AD, during the invasion of the Persians, when the Christians were most powerful and successful in the Holy Land, the small group of remaining Jews plotted against them with the Persians and spearheaded a campaign of genocide, which resulted in the destruction of hundreds of churches and the wholesale slaughter of Christians. The only church to survive the siege was the Church of the Nativity, which the Persians forbid be destroyed because of the illustrations inside of the Magi, whom they saw as being Persian kings. Jews bought Christians as slaves only to execute them. Finally, the Persians realized the magnitude of the killing and put a stop to it. Of course, European Christians in particular have returned the favor in their own persecution of Jews. American ignorance about the Christian presence in the Middle East is illustrated by an actual experience of a friend of mine. She's a Palestinian, and upon being introduced to an American friend of mine as a Christian, she was asked who converted her family. After a few seconds of thought, she said, I think it was St. Peter. Americans also do not realize that the little town of Bethlehem is populated principally by Christians. During the incursions of 2002, Israeli tanks crushed every Palestinian car on the streets, invaded many homes, committed extreme vandalism of personal property, particularly computers and electronic equipment, stole all the money in the homes, attacked government buildings and schools where they destroyed all records and equipment, and even defecated into the vandalized rubble. The Palestinian civilians who took to the Church of the Nativity for refuge were about 200. Some of them badly wounded, some sick, some were policemen, and a few were armed youth, determined to fight the enemy who sought to destroy them. These young resistance fighters are, of course, labeled militants or terrorists in our media. But our media doesn't stop there. Throughout the siege, all 200 Palestinian victims were labeled militants. For over 45 days, these people were holed up under constant fire with no water, food, or sanitation. Moving from the main room of the church was very dangerous, for Israeli snipers shot at any head that passed a window. When the church was finally released from its special hell, I was watching KSL News. Dick Norris curled his lip in contempt as he read about the conditions of the interior of the church following the siege, noting that the altar had been used to cook on and that the stench of urine was overwhelming. My goodness, Mr. Norris, have you ever been under siege with 200 other people in one room for that long under those terrible conditions? Where is your compassion for the victims of the cruel oppressors who violate Palestinian life and rights every single day? Would you even dream of tolerating such treatment for yourself and your families? You know you would not. Americans know that they would fight to the bitter end in any way possible to retain their rights and to defend their land. But in this case, Americans regard the Jews more or less as gods and the Palestinians as just a little above insects. Now that's racism, or is it that we identify the Zionists as we do ourselves with regard to the treatment of the Native American? We have never corrected our own injustices toward the Indians, so we subconsciously excuse the Zionists for the same atrocities and nasty attitudes and financially ensure their victory. Something to think about. On the first part of the 20th century, following a devastating war, the world united and decided that certain laws of international conduct must be implemented in order to prevent future deadly conflicts. Although the League of Nations failed in preventing a yet more destructive war, the Second World War, the world set about again in forming the United Nations, which is founded upon true principles of civil behavior and justice for all nations. In the rules set down by the world community, no nation would again be allowed to aggress on another, and all peoples were guaranteed the right to resist by any means possible any aggression or oppression upon them. The entire world recognizes and respects these laws, and those that who do not are brought to justice, except for the United States and Israel. The United States and Israel believe themselves above these universal laws, as we repeatedly have witnessed, particularly in the last few years. Both of these countries have declared that Palestinians are the only people on earth with no humanity, dignity, or right to defend themselves, their families, their religions, or their lands. These claims are built upon sloppy interpretation of scripture, racism, and pure ignorance. But what does Jewish scripture say about the return? According to the Torah faithful Jews, who are ultra-Orthodox, the establishment of the State of Israel is a direct affront to God and His commandments. In Jewish scripture, in Kisubus 111a, the Creator expressly forbids that the Jews, number one, go en masse to the land of Israel, number two, they're not to rebel against the nations, and number three, they're not to attempt in any way to end their exile. Jews are to behave in a civil, honest, and grateful manner toward their hosts throughout the world until God himself comes to lead them to the lands of their inheritance. One must remember that the Zionist movement is a political movement and not a religious movement. It misuses scripture to serve its own designs. To which Jews should we be listening? The authentic rabbis who follow Jewish law to the letter, or the secular leaders who don't even bother to practice their religion? The soul of the Jewish people is at stake, and they are worshiping at the altar of the modern-day golden calf, the State of Israel. Those of us who follow them are doing the exact same thing while these noble, Torah-faithful Jews pray for the peaceful end to the belligerent state of Israel, replacing it with a free Palestine, and a free Jerusalem, where all religions can live in peace. It is imperative to note that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has never come out in support of the State of Israel. The Church will only condone peace and true justice for all. Regrettably, only a tiny fraction of our membership of the church realizes this. The rest have fallen into the same deception which plagues the majority of the great nation's population. As members of the church, We have the latest word in Scripture, and we should be consulting and carefully examining our own sources instead of allowing others to do our interpreting for us. To blindly follow the masses is to abandon our precious calling, to go forth into the world and to preach the truth. Sadly, many Mormons are among those vigorous supporters of any and all of Israel's crimes. As Palestinians have told me, these Mormons are not serving God, but in my view, just the opposite. By their actions, the church will be judged, and it is frightening when one